From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council South Asia Center and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And here are the issues. A major city in northern Syria and Anbar province in Iraq are threatened with capture by ISIS terrorists amid concerns the war against ISIS is going poorly and a disagreement over strategy between the United States and Turkey. Meanwhile, worries about the spread of Ebola in the United States and around the world are increasing. In Hong Kong, the Beijing-backed government called off talks with protesting students and democracy advocates. And in the midterm election campaign in the U.S., President Obama has been on the sidelines, except as a fundraiser for his party. Well, David, I'm going to start with you because I'm going to read the first sentence in the story from The Economist on the Middle East, on Iraq, Syria, and jihadism, as it's subtitled. These are early days, but the campaign that Barack Obama announced almost exactly a month ago to, quote, degrade and ultimately destroy Islamic State, that's ISIS, is not going well. I read that because I think that there is a general consensus that that's the case at the moment. And in fact, these are early days, however.
That's right. And more painfully still, I mean, the big picture, not just of this campaign, but if you think back to a big speech that the president gave earlier this year when he described how he saw his vision of America using military force around the world in general, He said it was going to be, it was at West Point, the military academy, he said it was going to involve working much more closely with allies, with the regional partners. That was how it was going to work. And that has now smacked into the hard wall of reality, because the ally that has tanks yards, meters away from a big fight with the Islamic State, Turkey, a NATO ally, the one that has the tanks there, takes a different view of who should be fought, takes a different view of the priorities down there. It would much rather have a fight with the Assad regime far away in Damascus than actually help this Kurdish village on the border. So you see, not only is the war, this limited war, not achieving its limited objectives, but I think the grander strategy that America could somehow avoid returning to the kind of the days of the Bush era and hundreds of thousands of American troops on the ground, the big smart idea that regional allies with more skin in the game would do the fighting for them. The problem is, if you give the allies the lead, they get a say in what they do. And at the moment, this crucial ally, Turkey, is saying no.
Why? I mean, why is Turkey so recalcitrant here? Wouldn't it be to their benefit to step in and save this town in Syria that's right on their border and help destroy ISIS?
I think it's partly a simple question of distance. Sitting here in Washington, D.C., you look at the maelstrom in that region, and IS, Islamic State, looks like by far the worst threat right now, and that's the one you should focus on. But if you're sitting in Ankara, or if you're sitting on the Turkish border, it all looks much, much more complicated. It's much less clear that Islamic State is the worst threat. Let's not forget that this small town, Kobani, which is currently under terrible, terrible pressure, basically Islamic State has some of the suburbs of this town. It's probably going to fall any minute now, within sight of Turkish tanks. The force fighting Islamic State are Kurdish Peshmerga, who are from a group that is affiliated to a Kurdish political party, the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, who have spent 30 years fighting the Turkish government. Yeah, because Turkey has its own beefs with Kurdistan.
Yeah, Barbara, go ahead.
Yeah, but the PKK, I mean, this is where it gets even more complicated. They're involved in so-called peace talks with the Turkish government. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people see what's going on as a ploy by Erdogan, the president of Turkey, to get even more concessions from the PKK in terms of an ultimate agreement between Turkey and its Kurds. What's happened, though, is that this has caused massive demonstrations, protest demonstrations now in Turkey among its Kurdish population, which is significant. So I think if you draw back from it, you know, it's a coalition, yes, but every member of this so-called coalition against the Islamic State has his or her own agenda. And they are all trying to push forward various priorities that are sometimes at odds with the overall priority of hitting the Islamic State. I think for the Obama administration, you understand now why they were so reluctant to get drawn in at all. And I think the red lines, if there are any, are still pretty limited. The U.S., as you remember, didn't start bombing until Erbil, the capital of the Kurdish regional government in northern Iraq, was threatened, and Baghdad itself was threatened. Mm-hmm. So I think Erbil and Baghdad are two red lines the U.S. wants to safeguard. But as far as the rest, Anbar province, that's a largely Sunni province that's been very hostile to the Baghdad government. And it may be that we really have to accept the breakup of Iraq and of Syria, ultimately, as the only way to resolve this.
And let me clear up one thing that I may have said incorrectly. David, you call this town Kobani in northern Syria a hamlet and a small town. I call it a major city. What is it? Maybe I was wrong.
I think it's a substantial town. But
It was a substantial town.
Is it really a strategic place?
No, I think we're into a very strange situation, because are we playing cold-blooded realpolitik, where America has an overwhelming national security objective, or are we playing humanitarian rescue? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of the things that's been so confusing recently. I was at a Washington dinner party a few days ago, and people were talking about the initial rescue for the Yazidi religious minority on Mount Sinjar, and now talking about all the TV cameras filming from the safety of Turkey this fight going on in Kobani. And that clearly has a gigantic galvanizing effect on public opinion, because these are tragic circumstances and terrible pictures. But the truth is, as one person at this party said, you don't want to base your national security strategy on places you have to Google. until last week, very few people in this town knew that there was a town called Kobani, and very few people knew there was a religious minority called the Yazidis. Mm-hmm. So one of the most senior officials I've spoken to about this recently said a line that's different from the mainstream administration, which is, we should be focusing entirely on Iraq. We should be entirely cold-blooded and just say, in Syria, that's not our fight. If Islamic State wants to fight Assad, for a while that may suit us. They can keep each other bottled up. But Iraq really is falling apart. Yeah. Baghdad is not as secure as we need it to be. Focus on Iraq, where we can make a difference, where we do have at least some hopes of building ground forces, standing up some units fairly quickly. Syria is just a maelstrom, a sort of a snake pit that is beyond us. Now, whether that presupposes a kind of hermetic seal between Iraq and Syria that doesn't exist, I'm not expert enough. Barbara is much more expert in this region than I am.
That's the problem, that if you don't deal with Syria, you can't save Iraq ultimately because of the open border. There's another concern too that I'm hearing from humanitarian agencies, which is that if the Islamic State takes Kobani and in more areas in northern Syria along the border with Turkey, it's going to be very difficult to get any kind of humanitarian aid into those areas, and we're going to see even more tragedies. One thing about Kobani, though, most of its population has left. Most of them are already in Turkey, so there may be a few thousand people left there. Unfortunately, many of them elderly, and the most vulnerable elements of the population who couldn't get out are apparently still there. But David's absolutely right. I mean, there have been so many tragedies that we've ignored in Syria over the last 3 years, ignored or simply were unable to prevent, barrel bombs, chemical weapons, etc. So to focus on this one town perhaps is unfair. But the larger strategy is in question, and that is, can the United States really accomplish much just with airstrikes without American boots on the ground, when the boots that are on the ground, as I say, have conflicting agendas and are not always able or willing to fight?
Well, that was the question I was going to ask. look, I don't fault President Obama for favoring a limited war. You don't want to jump right in with some massive American force, ground troops and so on. But the pressure, Barbara, really is on him to do something, and that would be to expand the war effort.
Well, it's obviously not something he wants to have to do. But to save Erbil and to save Baghdad, it may be necessary. Another factor is a reevaluation of how we deal with the Iranians, frankly, on this, because they have a big role to play in safeguarding what's left of Iraq as well. And they cannot be happy to see the Islamic State spreading amoeba-like, all over northern and western Iraq and much of Syria now. Something is going to have to be done to constrain this group.
David, there's so many complicating questions here. What over the next few months do you think would be the best case scenario for the United States and the so-called coalition in this whole area? What's the best that can happen? Now, obviously, you won't have an Iraqi army that's been built up and will be a strongly functioning force. What is it? Is it mere containment? Is containment possible?
Well, I think that I'm not at all a military expert, but you do see interesting observations that, you know, the Islamic State's strength has been that it's at tremendous speed grabbed new territory to build this kind of caliphate that they would like to construct. But that is also their great vulnerability, because insurgents who aren't particularly interested in holding territory, they're very hard to fight for a conventional army. But if your aim is to actually hold lots of territory, then you need to keep that territory, and you have to put stuff in it that can be attacked. And so, you know, maybe there are military things that could be done. The thing that really worries me is a mismatch between what you describe correctly on the ground as, you know, containment or some sort of structure that we could imagine containing it, maybe with some Sunni National Guard units stood up in Iraq and more help from a better behaved Iraqi central government and Kurds sort of working somehow better with the Turks and with the Iraqis, all of that stuff. But if you cross the Atlantic, if you come here to Washington, D.C., what really worries me is the politics just feels so different and so sort of inadequate, because essentially the American public is desperate for some sort of simple explanation of a good team to root for, bad guys to sort of whack, something that America can do to be on the side of the good guys and whacking the bad guys. And in that construct, you see some politicians, particularly those who have ambitions perhaps for running for the White House for the Republicans in a couple of years' time, they boil it down to Israel. We need to do something to protect Israel, therefore we can do no deals whatsoever with Iran, because the core thing is preventing Iran from building a nuclear bomb, so we have to protect Israel. Or we need to protect Christian minorities, you know, and they do need protecting, but they're frankly a very, very minor part of this piece, but they get talked about a very great deal, because if you're a Republican politician trying to explain this to your core voters, and you can have the good Israelis and the good Christians being whacked by the bad Muslims, that makes sense. But the problem is, as long as we're in those kind of tram tracks, that's a completely inadequate political foundation for the kind of complicated, difficult policies that could make a difference.
Well, let me ask you, Barbara, about Christians. One of the problems for Christians, I think, is they have generally been protected by, in Syria, the Assad regime.
Right.
And the Assad regime is certainly the enemy of Turkey and the United States, supposedly.
Well, is it? I mean, that's
well,
a real
that's
question.
A good question, yeah.
You know, by getting involved in Syria and fighting this group, the United States is bolstering Assad, who is now turning around and using his own resources, which are less than what they were, but still considerable, to whack the so-called moderate, more moderate members of the opposition. There is no way to hit ISIS in Syria without helping Assad at this point. And we still do not have a strategy to influence, remove, transition, you know, in Syria. So the contradictions are huge. I was at the UN for the UN General Assembly, and the Iranians, of course, were having great fun poking holes in the American strategy. President Rouhani accused the United States of creating a new terrorist group because we've promised now to send some more arms to, what, 5,000? Some pittance of moderate rebel fighters, and even that, of course, isn't happening yet, and it's not supposed to happen for a while. You know, the Iranians see this as very clear-cut. You either support the central government of a country, or you support the terrorists. That's how they put it. I mean, they're very good at painting things for their population that's quite simple and black and white, and they do the same thing in Iraq. They say you support the central government, or you support the terrorists. For the United States, though, we are against both the terrorists and the central government. And we really don't have a good alternative in Syria. That's why I think poor Kobani will probably go, and that the U.S., to the extent that it's conducting airstrikes in Syria and so on, will be very careful to try to hit supply lines that affect Iraq. That is going to remain the focus.
I don't know. It seems to me that what would precipitate a stronger American buildup of forces would be if Baghdad is threatened.
Yeah, and clearly, I mean, why are we in this place at all? Let's not forget that until...
Because of George W.
I mean, go back far enough, and of course, yeah, Iraq is in the mess that it is in because an appallingly mishandled invasion was followed by an appallingly mishandled occupation. But the other reason that we're in this place right now with a president who had no intention of being back in combat in Iraq, and we are now, is because about a couple of months ago, they really got very frightened, very, very frightened that Erbil, the capital of Kurdistan, as Barbara mentioned, was going to fall. But they got pretty frightened that Baghdad was going to fall. I mean, that was the big change. That was the big change. Now, in public, it was all about the Yazidi religious minority on the top of Mount Sinjar. They got lucky. I mean, their timing was lucky.
Yeah.
They were being attacked at the moment that Erbil looked like it was going to fall. That was what happened. And that was a pretty serious issue. And one of the ironies here is that one of the few genuine successes in President Obama's recent policy was toppling Prime Minister Maliki, Nouri al-Maliki in Iraq, who had been viciously sectarian on behalf of his Shiite sect, who had really alienated the Sunni majority in Iraq to a terrible extent. How did we get him out? By withholding American military support until he left. And so that's a classic example of kind of withholding American power can sometimes, in narrow circumstances, give you leverage. But the problem is that's not on the table now. And saying that we're not going to have ground troops, saying that we're going to rely on allies, every time you announce that you're fighting a limited war, you lose leverage. There are trade-offs all across the piece here. And we have a president who's now putting his faith, at least in public, in arming the moderate rebels in Syria, a policy that he himself described as a fantasy a few weeks ago. So we're where we are because we can't do nothing. But I don't think anyone has any real confidence that this president believes that what he's doing right now can work, because he was the best and most articulate spokesman for the opposite view a couple of months ago, that this stuff wouldn't work.
Indeed. Well, we could discuss this for the entire show, but we won't. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show are David Rennie of The Economist and Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Secretary of State John Kerry, Barbara, has said that the world hasn't done enough to fight the Ebola spread and must do more. There are worries in the United States after this one a person who came from Liberia was released from the hospital initially. It wasn't handled well, and he ultimately died. And there's great distrust when the U.S. government announces, don't worry, we have everything's in place to fight Ebola. And that doesn't seem to be the case. But where do we stand on this? Mm-hmm. How much should people worry about this? Can it be really just kept in West Africa?
Well, it's not just in West Africa. As you point out, we've already had a patient who died here in the U.S. We've had others who've been treated, primarily healthcare workers. I think there's an NBC cameraman who contracted it. Mm-hmm. Brought back to the U.S. for treatment, so far successfully.
Well, that's only two people, though.
Yeah, there's a patient in Spain. There are some patients in Germany, people who've been brought from West Africa to Germany for treatment. So in a sense, I mean, it's already out of the box. I think the real emphasis has to be on containing it in Africa. Finally, the United States is sending troops to West Africa to build hospitals, treatment centers, testing centers, because the governments there simply don't have the capacity. It's run away from them. They're too poor. They've been through civil wars and trauma. And so the effort has to be to stop it in Africa. Otherwise, we do have a worldwide health emergency.
David, I don't have in front of me a quote from The Economist about whether the war against Ebola is doing well or not, but what's your take?
Personally, I would say that the debate that is going on here in America about whether this is President Obama's fault or whether America should panic is somewhat grotesque. You know, there are countries in the world that should be frightened of Ebola.
Sure.
America
mm-hmm.
is not currently one of them. But in mm-hmm. Africa, it is unbelievably serious, because the simple explanation for what is going on is that what was a rural disease has now become a disease of the crowded cities of Africa. And that is unprecedented, and that is extreme. Let's not forget, we've known about this disease. It's been studied intensively since 1976. It's not new. What is new is Ebola in big cities, mm-hmm. And big cities that are too crowded and too poor to do the usual kind of isolation and quarantine and public health measures. So that is a very, very serious development. If only we spent less time panicking about, you know, what's happening here. America is going to be fine. America has, you know, the world's best healthcare system. But what's happening in Africa is very, very shocking and is not over. And even the efforts that the outside world is pouring in are still painfully inadequate. And one of the tragedies here is, you know, part of it is asking very, very poor Africans to do the right thing, to put their hands up and admit when they have the symptoms or a member of their family has the symptoms. Mm-hmm. If you're asking people to do that, mm-hmm. you are asking them to risk being lynched by their neighbors, having their house burned down by their neighbors, at least being shunned by their neighbors. If you're going to ask them to take that unbelievable risk by being responsible, you have to have something to offer them. You have to have medical care and doctors and hospitals, something, rather than just dying on the street, shunned. And at the moment, those doctors are not there in the numbers that you would need. So we are lecturing Africans to behave themselves without actually offering them the kind of resources that we need to stop this becoming a global pandemic.
Yeah, Barbara, in the short run, is it adequate what has been ordered by health officials in the United States to test people coming from West Africa at airports?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable thing to do. And certainly by now, everybody is aware of what this disease is and if they are ever in contact with anyone who's come from West Africa and so on. If there is a bright spot, one could mention is that they're intensifying efforts to come up with vaccines now. Mm-hmm. And there's some promising leads. There's some treatments that have come. And, of course, a vaccine, if they could perfect one and use it widely in the most affected areas in Africa, would be tremendous. We've mm-hmm. been able to deal with diseases like polio.
But in terms of the vaccine, that would stop the next outbreak.
Yeah,
vaccine is not going to stop this outbreak.
Sure.
This outbreak, there's
right.
only
but,
one
but
way to
but
stop
if you
it.
Can, if you can vaccinate, if you can vaccinate the healthcare workers, one of the most troubling
For
aspects
sure.
of this
yeah.
disease has been that healthcare workers are dying in Africa, the very people you need. Mm-hmm. So if you can vaccinate the healthcare workers, that will give them confidence, more confidence to go in and actually deal with the epidemic that we have.
Hong Kong. Yeah, David, you spent a number of years in China. I'm sure you've been to Hong Kong many, many times.
Many, many times, yeah.
It seems like the government, the Beijing-backed government in Hong Kong, has decided we're going to just stiff these protesters. They're going to go away. Their protest is dying, and we don't have to negotiate with them, and they've refused to.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm afraid that the Hong Kong pro-democracy protesters, with whom I have enormous sympathy, their timing is lousy. The world is too busy. You know, we got Ebola, we've got Islamic State, we don't care, we're not going to do anything for them. And also China is big and rich and growing and we're not going to help them. So essentially what China has decided is you have this city which they inherited from the British, which had still getting less robust free press, good courts, good rule of law. It was handed over at the very last minute with something pretty close to full parliamentary democracy. Shamefully, Britain had only given that in the last couple of years of British rule, had resisted before then. And the Chinese basically gratefully accepted the colonial model and reimposed it on Hong Kong. The tragedy we're seeing now is, the big picture tragedy is, you know, apologists for the Chinese government in Beijing say, you know, they're planning to build a big Singapore, something that's going to be kind of technocratic and you know, pretty efficient. What they've done here in Hong Kong is Putinism. You know, sending thugs in, gangsters from the triad gangs to beat these students up so they can then say, oh, it's violent, we need to shut it down. Mm-hmm. Having absolutely no desire to stick to their own obligations to expand the sort of the voting electorate in Hong Kong. This is Putinism. They're going to end up with a city in Hong Kong that looks a lot like every other big Chinese city of 8 million people. They've got enough cities of 8 million people. You'd think they would want one that was slightly different. But the interest, the overwhelming interest of the Chinese Communist Party is one party rule. And so Hong Kong gets it.
Well, David certainly didn't sugarcoat it, Barbara.
No.
What about it? I mean, it is sort of cynical to say, I'm not accusing you of that, David, but cynical to say, hey, protesters, get your timing right.
Yeah, well, also, I mean, the Chinese have learned a thing or two since Tiananmen. There have been cases where tear gas was used and so on, but, you know, we haven't seen tanks coming in and we haven't seen innocent people being mowed down in droves. So I think it's a waiting game. And already we've seen periods when there have been very few demonstrators there. Now, apparently over the weekend, you know, there'll be more, that kind of thing. People are hunkering down. But as somebody who is a veteran of protests myself, I know that, you know, it gets tiresome to actually sit on the street for hours and hours and days at a time. And it's hard to keep up the momentum. So I think it's very wise for them mm-hmm. to simply wait it out. It would be helpful if they would get rid of the chief executive of Hong Kong, who's apparently a much hated figure. But if I were the Chinese, I would be patient and perhaps throw a few crumbs at the pro-democracy demonstrators once the back of the protests appears to have been broken.
Well, maybe they're assuming that, look, these are student protests. At some point, these students are going to have to go to class. All right. The midterm election in the United States. This is a piece from the New York Times I'm reading from by Jonathan Martin, who's a political reporter there. And he says this about what has happened to President Obama during this period. He refers to him as an isolated political figure who is viewed as a liability to Democrats in the very states where voters by the thousands had once stood to cheer him. Mm. The president is a great fundraiser. He's helped his party enormously there. But he's not out doing actual campaigning. Before you say this, Barbara, I will say it. The same thing happened to President Bush
sure.
When he was unpopular as well.
Yeah, well, look, President Obama's approval ratings are below 50%. So he is definitely a liability in a lot of places where there are close races. There's no doubt about it. So I think he is wisely confining himself to giving speeches to to, you know, preaching to the converted and raising money. That's certainly what he's doing to try to help the Democrats.
David?
I think, you know, it's a discussion for another day when we have more time, but I think basically in the rich world, voters want something from politicians that politicians can't give them. They want the past back. They want this imagined past of jobs for life and rapid growth, and it's not coming back. And so basically 6 years into any presidential cycle, I think every president from now on is doomed to be unpopular.
Well, oddly enough, the economy doesn't seem to be a big issue in this election.
Well, the economy, but the, you know, what people feel is, you know, no growth in real wage inflation for, you know, 30 years. I mean, basically, it's not as good a deal being a rich Westerner as it used to be.
David?
Can I say something else, too? Also, the Republicans, as we know, are incredibly good scaremongers. And, you know, there are a lot of things to be frightened of. So it was another piece, I think it was in the New York Times, where, you know, Republicans like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and Bobby Jindal, you know, they're accusing Obama of everything from creating the Ebola virus, or at least leaving Americans vulnerable to Ebola. The Daily Caller has christened him President Ebola. They've suggested that, you know, Ebola-infected people are coming across the Mexican border.
The prize goes to Representative Tom Cotton, a Republican who's trying to become the senator in Arkansas, who said this week that ISIS fighters are in Mexico hooking up with the Mexican drug cartels to cross the porous Mexican border. He didn't actually say they were bringing Ebola
with them, but, you know, that's the next step. Right?
To attack Arkansas.
Yeah, his opponent, by the way, Senator Mark Pryor, has accused Cotton of voting to have America not prepared.
Defund pandemics. That's true. Which Cotton didn't, and then he changed his mind and voted for pandemic reparation. Yeah.
It is a political campaign. Often they're not pretty things. I think we can all agree on that. Well, anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.